Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Should GLP-1 weight loss medication like Wegovy and Zepbound cost thousands of dollars? We don't think so. Try LifeMD.com helps provide insurance access to the leading GLP-1 medications. Visit TryLifeMD.com and check your eligibility for GLP-1 medication with copays as low as $0. Listen to Bridget's story after losing 55 pounds and using her insurance for coverage.
LifeMD helped me get covered with my insurance. Finding out that it was covered was huge. I've lost 55 pounds. I am so much healthier now that I've lost the weight. I would never be able to do it without them.
Get started today and check your eligibility for GLP-1 medication with copays as low as $0 at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
But this place is different. Special. The others don't want to talk about it because it scares them. But we all know it. We all feel it.
Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? Do you think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
The island.
Two players. Two sides. One is light. One is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back!
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a rewatch podcast. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and my confidence man partner would be Brad Pitt from Ocean's 11 because he's always eating something.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and my fictional con man partner would be a con woman, Annette Bening from The Grifters.
And I'm Neil Miller, and my con man partner is a con man and con woman, Nicolas Cage from the movie Matchstick Men, and his daughter, played by Alison Lohman. They're great. And I feel like we would have a fun time.
Are you the Sam Rockwell of this arrangement then?
Yeah, but I'm a more chill version.
I have a follow-up question for Dave Gonzalez really quickly. Even though you just want to announce what podcasts are doing, but do you want Brad Pitt, who is always eating, because, and I believe Neil was a witness to this, you told me quite recently that you find eating to be a waste of time.
Uh-huh, so we're ironic confidence man partners. And he looks like Brad Pitt, and I look like me, and just like together. I mean, you'd probably think we were up to something, but probably not what we were really up to, you know?
Uh-huh.
Okay, but now I'm imagining like a scenario where you're both wearing brightly colored suits, and now it's becoming Dumb and Dumber.
Mm-hmm. And it's not that far off, I think, but like Dumb and Dumber with a con man. Why are we talking about con man? Because we're here to discuss season 1, episode 8, Confidence Man. And this is, of course, the ABC show Lost. You're listening to The Storm, a Lost rewatch podcast. We split our podcast into two sections, a calm section that also includes an interview that has no spoilers up through what we've rewatched so far. So the pilot through Confidence Man, episode 8, is all we could discuss in the calm. Then we have a second part we like to call The Storm. That's where all the spoilers of Lost being a television show that has finished its run and had many pop culture critics touch upon it. That's where we could take all of that knowledge plus your crazy Storm thoughts and mix it into a swirling maelstrom of podcast goodness. But first, Joanna, do we have any reviews for this Lost Rewatch podcast?
We do have some reviews for this Lost Rewatch podcast. Quickly before I get to the reviews, I do want to mention that our guest this week on the show is the lovely Kristen Russo. The other half of the Buffering podcast is on this week to talk about something that she is an expert in, and we have had many conversations about, which is problematic faves, of which Sawyer definitely counts. So Kristen and I have bonded over the years over our shared love of Spike on Buffy and Jaime Lannister on Game of Thrones. So Sawyer makes it a hat trick. So you will hear from her a little later on. But first, let us hear from some reviews. This one comes from Tony Sparkles, who I believe is in our Slack, if not on the Twitters at least. But best podcast, always makes my week, 5 stars. I've been listening to this podcast since season 5 of Game of Thrones. So I'm not an OG, but I've been listening long enough. I feel bad it's taking me this long to write a review. I love Joanna, Neil, and Dave so much that now when I say Joanna said to my husband, I don't have to preface it anymore with the girl from the podcast I love, because the storm has become part of our lives. I love the dynamic they have, and this podcast makes me feel like I'm with 3 well-informed friends talking about stuff I love. I was a huge Lost fan back in the day, and when y'all announced that Lost was the next topic, I almost cried and immediately joined the Patreon small council because I love every minute of it. Joanna, never change. You are a goddess of pop culture. Thank you. Dave, I love when you say, and it is 22 meetings, all of them great. Neil, you're my fave, and I love you, your forever chill vibes. My week immediately gets better when I hear Dave say hello and welcome. Thank you for bringing me much needed levity to an often stressed out high school teacher. You guys are the best in the game. So that is from Tony. And then we have a slightly less enthused review from someone who, from Becca. Becca says, sad to see the pod ripped apart, 1 star. Sad to see the off-season tour completely gone. I had held out hope that the Lost thing was just a phase to get to more relevant coverage, but alas, I have learned that the off-season segments are now behind a paywall. The only reason I stayed subscribed for Game of Thrones was over. Good luck, and a shame to see you run listeners off. So, don't love Becca's tone there, but I do want to let people know that if you want our off-season tour-esque content, it is behind a paywall, but it is like pretty cheap at the price. $5 Patreon level to listen to what we call Storm Chasing, which is essentially the off-season tour. And if you are at a $10 level, you get something that no one has ever gotten before, except for that one time when we did a poll, which is the chance to like pick what we talk about in the Storm Chasing once a month. So there's some options there.
I know. Also, in the metric of like running listeners off, we did better than Game of Thrones in the end of Game of Thrones transition. So I feel kind of like, okay.
Well, I don't know.
We stuck the landing in comparison.
I think they still had plenty of viewers. Numbers wise, I think they did fine in the end. But, you know, emotionally, you might be right. Anyway, we are sorry to lose listeners, and we are sorry, to not be the podcast that everyone wants it to be all the time. That being said, we've gotten a ton of new listeners who are really excited about a Lost podcast. So, you know, silver lining. We're talking about something we love, and there's a bunch of new folks in the family, so that's fun too. So thank you guys all. You can leave us a review. We would greatly appreciate it on iTunes. Thanks so much. Neil, over to you.
Yes, it's great that you mentioned the Patreon and the Choose Your Own Storm, because this week, if you're listening to this in real time and you are a member of the Patreon, you'll be getting a very special Spider-Man themed episode that was chosen by the small council. So that's pretty awesome. Even if you're not listening to this in real time, you can always sign up to the Patreon and then come on back and listen to the Spider-Man episode. It's great. I'm sure it's great.
So sorry, real quickly, we should probably mention that we have like a few new places that people can find us.
Yeah.
We have a shiny web page. I believe the kids call it a web page. Stormpodcast.com. And then If you are looking for us on Twitter, we are now at Storm Podcast. You don't need to like refollow us or anything like that. If you're already following at Storm of Spoilers on Twitter, you'll notice you are now following at Storm Podcast. We've just changed our name, but the destination is the same.
So. Pulled the rug right out from underneath you.
And then put now a new one. A shiny new one.
It's a newer, bluer rug.
There you go. Sorry. All right.
Awesome. No, great point. Okay, so this week in found signals, we're going to give the spoiler bleeps button a week off, finally. and we're actually going to talk about something from last week's episode. And this is an email from that we got from Luke in New York. It was actually a long email, so I'm going to paraphrase a bunch of it. Apologies to Luke in advance when I inevitably get some of it wrong. But Luke sent us an email talking about how there's an argument to be made that casting real musicians creates a sense of authenticity on screen, especially when they have to like play the guitar and things like that. For example, once John Carney taking the lead role. Apparently, someone else was. Who was it that was?
Me.
Rumor.
Falling slowly like a.
Wait, what was your question?
Who? There was somebody who was mentioned to be in the running for that role instead of John Carney, and then they turned it down, and John Carney took it. Anyway, that's not relevant to this. This authenticity of which Luke speaks is something that Dominic Monaghan, despite his really wonderful performance as Charlie, doesn't exactly have, because I don't believe that he was a rock star previous to this. He was a hobbit. So Luke's question for us, he asks, if you were running Lost in 2004 and ABC told you that you had to cast a real musician, and I'd say presumably so that they could do some sort of song on the soundtrack and a nice like promo tie-in, because they did that back then, who would you have cast? And I have added a rule that you cannot choose either of the Oasis dudes, because that's just way too easy. So let's start with Dave. Dave, which 2004-ish relevant rock star are you casting as Charlie?
So I had a flash in my mind when I got this question of the music video for Take My Picture by Filter. And I was like, that's like 99, 2000 when that's like popular. So by the time Lost comes around in 2004, he's not going to be the most popular person on the show. He's not even like Hobbit level of famous, but you could probably get Richard Patrick, the lead singer from Filter. And then also you could just use good pre-existing Filter songs. You know, like, hey man, nice shot for your intense promos. And just leave it at that. But like, life imitating art, I think, would be easy for Richard Patrick. I don't know how I'd feel about him. Damn it. I'm going to bleep that because I was going to.
Wait. Before we get to Neil's answer, can I drop some once knowledge on you?
Yes.
All right. So the lead of Once, the film, is Glenn Hansard, who, John Carney's the director. Glenn Hansard was the lead singer of The Frames. He's also in the movie The Commitments as like, I don't know, the bassist probably. He's in The Frames, and then Carney was the bassist in The Frames. So like they were bandmates, but you were right that originally John Carney wanted to cast Cillian Murphy in the lead.
Yeah, there we go.
And Cillian Murphy, this is according to Wikipedia, Murphy declined the prospect of acting opposite non-actor Markéta Ergilova, then 17 years old, and also felt he hadn't the vocal capabilities to belt out Hansard's octave leaping song. So he pulled out. As did the film's other producers, along with their financial resources. So, like, that was a bad choice. I mean, maybe
he almost Cillian Murphy'd it.
Maybe Cillian couldn't have sung it as well. So maybe it's better that Glenn did it, because Glenn did a great job, even though he's like kind of a non-actor. But to be like, I won't appear opposite this girl who like then won an Oscar for best song. Do you have an Oscar, Cillian Murphy? No, you don't. Your eyes, your blue eyes, should have an Oscar, but you don't. So Markéta does. End of story.
Yeah. Also, one reason's good enough. Like, I can't sing it. Yeah. And I'm uncomfortable with that. That's enough. Go ahead and turn down the job. That's fine.
Yeah. No need to drag the 17-year-old into it, who's fantastic in that film. All right. Sorry. That's my once trivia.
All right. Well, then I will go next. Mine, I am gender swapping it, but we're keeping the name Charlie because it works.
Love it.
And we're casting Avril Lavigne. Just to make things so complicated. Also, I'm assuming here that we're making them do the Manchester accent anyway. So I feel
she's got that loose tie style that would be the most 2004
sure.
thing.
What
a
I'm
tie
saying
to
is
an island. That's a joke for the Storm listeners.
The show needs more Canadians who are doing non-Canadian accents. So like if every once in a while we get an Evangeline Lilly like oot slips Boot. Out, I feel like we just need a couple more of those in Lost. That would be part of my plan.
I love it.
So that's Avril Lavigne on Lost. Sorry. Joanna.
Oh, here I come to make your
go ahead.
Controversial choice look non-controversial by comparison. All right, bear with me with my choice here. It's 2004. We want someone who can act and someone who is ostensibly a musician. I submit, for the Midnight Society, Jared Leto. Here, listen to me. Listen very well. He has already started doing the musician thing. 30 Seconds to Mars was founded in 1998. So he's already a musician. He's past his My So-Called Life glory. That was mid 90s, right? And right now in the 2004s, he's into like his Panic Room, A Beautiful Lie. I don't even know what A Beautiful Lie is. Oh, that's a 30 Seconds to Mars album. Great. Panic Room, then, Alexander phase of his career. So like, he's not quite like back. He's sort of like floating around, right? He did Fight Club. He did, Requiem for a Dream, right? And so he's like around and people are like interested. He's not just Jordan Catalano. He's Jared Leto. We're interested, but he's not become the insufferable monster that he will then become. My other theory of like putting Jared Leto in this role is, what if we,
he has a cheekbones off with Boone.
Yeah. No, what if, we change history? And Jared Leto becomes exactly Dominic Monaghan level famous instead. And how did you put it, Neil? We save the Joker? Like, Jared Leto never makes the Joker.
From Jared Leto?
He never makes Blade
this
Runner.
Is...
He never sends fetal pigs and like used condoms and whatever else he sent to Margot Robbie. Like, none of that ever happens. So. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's my question about Jared Leto though. In 2004, was he already method acting? Because I feel like whenever that started is what we need to try and swerve away from.
Well, I think that would like also just manifest as like Jared Leto's living in Hawaii and he refuses to hang out with everybody in between. Right.
Or he like really does a bunch of heroin and then detoxes.
Well, apparently when he was going to play Harry Goldfarb in Requiem for a Dream, he lived on the streets of New York and refrained from having sex for 2 months prior to shooting.
Damn.
And he starved himself for months, losing 28 pounds to realistically play his heroin addict character. So yeah, he was already, and then he moved to Portugal and lived in a monastery for several months to gain weight. Oh my God, Jared Leto. Why? Anyway.
He was already weird.
Yeah. You're saying that's savable. And I'm saying that's a gamble.
No, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I don't want to inflict that on the cast of Lost. Anyway, who do our listeners think, should have been the musician in 2004 to cast in this role? I mean, I like Dom in this role, like, cause he's not the lead singer of the band, right? He just sings the chorus.
It's all about the music.
Yeah. And he can convincingly like strum and mumble songs, you know, on the beach, which he does sometimes. So I think Dom's fine in that role, honestly.
Yeah, me too. I wouldn't trade him.
Who would you stunt cast though of like the character? I guess you could stunt cast anybody because we just have a whole bunch of background characters.
I feel like this is a game we'll come back to.
Yes. And then we're going to, when we really come up with Lost twisting itself into knots to expand its cast.
Speaking of dream casting or stunt casting, last week on Storm Chasing, I believe it was, or maybe Mailbag, we talked about, like which older actor we would cast as Gambit. Like we were talking about
Keanu. Oh yeah. And we missed
Josh
somebody
Holloway.
Very important.
Josh Holloway as Gambit, aka Sawyer as Gambit, obviously. I put that in the Slack and someone like rightly was like, he's too old. I was like, no. Listen, we were talking about Keanu Reeves and Kevin Bacon. Josh Holloway is right in, he's much younger, actually.
Old Gambit. Old man Gambit.
Old man Gambit, Josh Holloway. I can't believe Josh Holloway hasn't already been Gambit. So there you go. News broke today that he got cast, on the Paramount series Yellowstone, which is just like, is that a show that really exists? I know I've seen it. I still don't believe that it exists.
They keep casting people I like, though. So it's like,
eventually they'll make
it. Maybe eventually I'll watch it.
Anyway,
just one of these days you'll take the bait.
Kevin Feige, if you're listening, this is what you should do with Gambit. The end.
We've solved it. We've solved Gambit.
I think so.
Let's move on to Confidence Man with Neil summing it up for us here in the calm.
Oh, quite a bit happens in this episode. This is Confidence Man, directed by Tucker Gates, written by Damon Lindelof. You'll remember that guy from being one of the showrunners. On the island, it is day 9. We open with Sawyer swimming in the nude. Kate notices that he reads Watership Down, and then Sawyer gets out of the water, and of course, makes it weird. Later, Boone raids Sawyer's stash, then gets punched, y'all. Later on after that, Kate reads Sawyer's letter out loud, be very specific about that, and discovers that maybe he destroyed some poor child's family. It's pretty dark. Elsewhere in the caves, Shannon has an asthma attack. This is the first we're learning about Shannon's asthma. I don't think that was in the show Bible. Maybe it was, I don't know.
It wasn't.
Locke gives Saeed both a pep talk and a knife, the latter of which he later uses to torture Sawyer in an effort to get Shannon's meds back. We'll get more on that later. Even after being tied to a tree in a jungle of mystery and tortured, Sawyer continues to be a creep about it, gets his kiss from Kate, and reveals that he did not have the meds all along. He just wants people to hate him. It's very Sawyer. There's a scuffle. Saeed stabs him. Jack then saves him, even though he's continuing to be a huge piece of shit about it. And Kate ultimately realizes that Sawyer was not the person who was the target of the letter, but the kid who wrote the letter.
Whoa!
And we realize that his backstory is very sad. Back at the caves, Sun gives Shannon some eucalyptus and she gets better, but it makes Jin suspicious. So keep an eye on that one. Charlie convinces Claire to move to the caves with quote-unquote peanut butter. It's very cute. And apparently she's the only Australian who likes peanut butter. I don't know if I've ever looked it up to see if that's true about Australians and peanut butter.
Guess what I Googled today?
Do Australians hate peanut butter?
Countries that hate peanut butter. I have a peanut butter anecdote. Are you ready?
Yes.
Or do you need to finish first?
No. This is the perfect place for this.
Great. So when I lived in Italy for a little while, it was great, but then you find out quickly that there are like some things that other countries don't have when you're an American abroad. And so when my sister came to visit me, she asked me what she could bring. I will like forever remember this, packing list that I sent her. I asked her to bring me, Diet Coke, because they don't have Diet Coke in Italy. They have like Coca-Cola Light is what they have in European countries. It tastes different. It's funny. Tylenol, like gel caps, something like that. I don't know why I couldn't get the kind of Tylenol I wanted in Italy. And then, a peanut butter. So my sister brought me peanut butter, Diet Coke, and Tylenol. This episode brought to you by peanut butter, Diet Coke, and Tylenol. But anyway, I will like forever remember the fact that I couldn't find any fucking peanut butter in Italy. And then there is like, if you Google countries that don't like peanut butter, there is a whole long list of countries that don't really they just don't really do it. You know what I mean?
Including Australia.
Australia wasn't on this specific list, but I believe that Australia, like I believe if that line's in there, like, I believe probably what happened. Here's my guess of what happened. They wrote the whole peanut butter scene. It's so cute. And then Emily DeRaven's like, crikey, Tommy Kangaroo's down. Australians don't really eat peanut butter. They're like, we're not cutting it. She's like, cool, let's throw in this line. I'm the only Australian who, yeah, no, okay. That's what I think happened.
All right. Well, hopefully people will email us if we're wrong. I'm sure they will.
Please email me compliments on my Australian accent. Thanks so much.
Excellent. Back at the beach, we're now toward the end of the episode on the island. Saeed leaves the camp in shame to do some cartography, make some maps. In flashbacks, we learn a few things. You see, Sawyer, he's a con man. And he got the name Sawyer from another con man. And he's pretty good at being a con man until a young boy walks into the room and he bails because demons. And then the whole thing wraps up with a montage set to I Shall Not Walk Alone by the Blind Boys of Alabama. Just a great, great episode ender. And it, the montage that it's set over, everyone's sort of getting into their new realities. Saeed is walking off to be a lone ranger of cartography. Claire is moving to the caves where she thinks she'll be very safe. And Sawyer is now a sad boy. And he can't even bring himself to burn his own letter. So that's where we, sort of end on that very happy note. Sad boy.
Can I do a dramatic reading of my favorite line from this episode? Even though that's a bit I do.
Please do.
Yes.
Goes like this. Baby, I am tied to a tree in a jungle of mystery.
I think we all wrote down that line in our notes, I'm guessing, because I also have that written down, and Neil referenced it in his recap. Yeah,
it's just like a pure Sawyerism.
Baby,
yeah.
I'm tied to a tree in a jungle of mystery. So good.
I think the quote goes on, but I also was like, I don't need to write the rest of it.
I almost wrote the rest of it down, then I was like, that's overkill. We could just leave it here. Yeah.
Especially because, like, two lines up from that quote, I have another quote from him that's just women are easy. And I have that highlighted with, like, a bunch of question marks. So let's start off here. Sawyer has been, controversial character thus far up on the island. Does this episode make him as sympathetic as it wants to through the lens of 2019 you? Joanna Robinson.
I, Joanna Robinson, in 2004, I was really feeling it. In 2019, I'm less feeling it. Though, so I have just completed a complete rewatch of Lost. I will say, like, eventually I get to the Sawyer feelings that I remember. But I think if people are watching it through the lens of 2019 and they're watching it right now and they're like, I don't get Joanna, why you like Sawyer? Yeah, I will say, I know. I see you, and I feel you, and I understand your feelings about this. The letter thing just feels a little overwrought. I will say, I think a lot of these, like, a question we've gotten, or some feedback we've gotten from listeners has been, and I mentioned already, I think I mentioned during the walkabout episode, but, like, this idea that, like, the show is sort of going out of its way, or the Sun and Jin episode, the show is going out of its way to lie to us about who these people are so that there's a big, like, whoa, reveal. Bet you never looked at it this way. What if he's the kid? And I think it is, like, it's a little clunky here in the beginning. And I will just say that I'm grateful that that goes away. That's not the whole show. You know what I mean? But it is the initial season of the show. And I like season one of Lost. I do. But I think it gets so much better once it sort of, breaks away from this premise. So that was a long way around to your question. I will say that, like, the scene, I do not think they would have the scene now of Josh Holloway gets out of the ocean and he's naked and he just, like, waggles his penis at Kate. Nor am I sure that they would have yeah, if you kiss me. I mean, like, okay, sorry. I guess I wasn't done with my story answer. I was watching this with Diana, who has never, our producer, my roommate, who has never seen Lost before. And even she was just like, I don't fucking buy this premise. Shannon's fucking gasping to death. This guy's like, no, I'm not going to give the inhalers. Nobody believes this premise. Nobody believes that Sawyer, like, except for, I guess, Saeed and Jack, but, like, nobody, including Kate, believes that Sawyer would just, like, withhold the inhalers because he's not, because he doesn't have them. So it's, like, it's a weird premise for the episode entirely. I don't know. That's how I feel.
Yeah. As a way to pivot over to Neil, there's a lot of cons in this episode, the majority of which are, you know, Sawyer-based A-story cons. But we also have, you know, well-meaning cons with the peanut butter fake out, and you know, to a lesser extent, but still, someone's getting one pulled over. Sun and Jin have to Sun has to keep her English speaking secret, but still, like, be of help. So, my question to you, Neil, is the remaining scene of the scenes in this episode, which is Charlie and Hurley walking through the jungle, and they deal with Hurley's weight, is there a con in there that I'm missing?
That's a tough one to answer. Maybe. Yeah. No. Well, okay. What?
I say no. You say no? But I say no.
Oh. I mean, a little bit. I just think that that's sort of something they go back to a lot, the Hurley's weight, and how Hurley doesn't lose weight on the island. Yeah, it's got its own sort of set of problems. I do think that this thing that we've been talking about, how this show is sort of actively manipulating us as the audience to be able to come back and reframe these characters, the thing that Joanna said, this episode leans into that in a bunch of different ways, as you guys described. It leans into it on sort of a bunch of different levels, because this is sort of the episode that's about the professional liar in their midst and his whole deal. So, I think that if the show being manipulative and obtuse about things has started to rub you the wrong way, this is like the real twist the knife version of the episode. But like Joanna said, I'm glad that they eventually sort of move away from this, but I also do appreciate how patient they were at the beginning there, because this, the 2019 version of my brain thinks that this should be going a lot faster, because that's how TV shows move now. And so there's this immense amount of patience to spend an entire episode, you know, on Sawyer as a con man and make it interesting on its own, but also sort of lay down track for later. And I think that's just, it's really something that's starting to open up to me as we pick through these season one episodes, is how patient they were by what they showed us and when. So, yeah, I kind of like Confidence Man. Also, Josh Holloway really delivers in this episode in a way that's surprising. I think, because he's easy in this first season to sort of pigeonhole Sawyer as, like, he's just that, you know, the hillbilly guy who's a real dick to everyone. But I think they've started to layer in some nuance for that character.
I think there are only, A, I agree with you. B, I mean, Josh Holloway is just like a charm machine. So, like, even when he's given like somewhat,
that's the thing, yeah,
somewhat clunky stuff, like in this episode and the last that we talked about, he delivers it. I think they're still playing by Survivor rules. Like, this feels like a very Survivor episode to me, even though there wasn't like bamboo under the fingernails torture in Survivor as far as I know. But like, this idea of like, I have something, you want it, what can you give me, sort of alliances, and who's the villain, is Sawyer the villain, sort of questions, that feels very Survivor to me. And I think eventually, once again, I think the show gets away from those roots. I will say, and I don't think it's a spoiler to say this, I think in this season there are only two more episodes that qualify total, that qualify as a major like character, kind of, this person's not who you think they are. So two more to get through, and then I think we're done with that gimmick, is what I'm saying. Looking at the season. Like, I don't think that's what next week's episode is. So, I mean, we don't have to talk about next week's episode yet, but next week's Saeed episode, and I don't think, like, I don't think that that's exactly what that episode's trying to do. So, I think they're on the cusp of moving away from it. A question that I have for, I want to circle back to that Hurley scene. I actually really like it. Like, as we talk about diversity on this show in terms of, like, 2004 and what people are allowed to look like on a show and stuff like that. And, you know, characters didn't like look like Hurley, and nor did they have the dignity that he has to like stand up to Charlie and be like, hey, fuck off. Like, fuck off with this comment. Like, that's not something that was often allowed to, characters who look like that in 2004, that they would often just, like, you know, be the fat joke. And, like, Sawyer just looks like an asshole and a bully for making fat jokes at Hurley, and it's not like he stops anytime soon, but, like, Hurley is a character with some of the most dignity ever on the island, I think. And so that's just something that lost it differently that a lot of shows didn't. So I like that scene because he stands up for himself. So
yeah, I like the way it's written, for sure.
I like how a lot of this episode is written. I just think some of the island stuff gets strangely paced because it has to mix in with the con that we see. But every time we return to a flashback of the con, we're supposed to be taking a different look at Sawyer's place in the con. So first flashback could actually just be a mistake. They, like, dumped money out, you know, with the suitcase. Second flashback, you, like, obviously realize that it's a con. He's probably going to, like, rope in this poor woman's husband. Third flashback, you're, like, completely... Sawyer's the most evil person on the show because at that point, he's being, like, tied up and tortured and still isn't doing anything. And then it isn't until he tells Jack that he would let him bleed out and die, which is basically towards the end of the episode, that we get to see the conclusion of the flashback sequence where he leaves the money with the kid. All of which I think is, that's a good flashback story, and it's interwoven to make a good hour of television. But if you put those two stories together, it feels like the monologue about the note with the child and the flashback conclusion happen, like, too close together to, like, have enough time to breathe. So, like, by the time that I'm trying to be like, I wonder why he gave up for the kid, I don't think my mind jumped ahead like Kate's did to he's the kid in the letter. So by the time I have that, it's not, I don't have enough time to process it. It's not like a don't tell me what I can't do lock reveal where I'm making the connection in my mind. Instead, Sawyer literally tells me what his hurt is and then, like, yells at Kate to, you know, not feel sorry for him, which just is such on-the-nose writing for an episode that was building to a climax that maybe didn't need him to explain all the note. I don't know. This episode didn't bother me so much in previous rewatches because in the pace of the whole thing, I think Sawyer's backstory isn't interesting at this point. The facts are all in that speech that I just said I didn't like. But thinking of it as like a single episode, the Charlie Hurley scene jumps out at me for being different, and that monologue jumps out at me for being like, you could have given Josh Holloway less to work with than a huge monologue,
and I think,
and they didn't.
I think they underestimate him, and I think that they'll figure that out eventually with him quickly. I think with him and some other actors, they'll be like, oh, we can give them barely anything and they could just sell it with a look, you know what I mean? And that's like, Josh Holloway is an actor who is so perfectly suited to the role of Sawyer. It's sort of, you know, that speaking of fictional gambits, it's sort of like Tim Riggins, like that you, he's so perfect for this role that A, he's had a hard time finding like a great role after, and B, it becomes this seamless marriage of actor and role. And so you just have to barely give him anything at all and he could just make a whole meal out of it. So.
Like if the switch flips for me into being on Sawyer's side this episode, it's not in the monologue about the letter. It's in how he looks at Kate when Kate's about to kiss him,
yes,
and how long the kiss goes
after.
On.
After that is such a good kiss. Like, I don't know how often we do like thirst on this podcast. We don't do it that often, but like, I wrote in my notes.
I mean, we've had a lot of occasion to talk about
it. I remember it was problematic kiss, but it's hot, all caps. Like, that is a hot-ass kiss between Evangeline Lilly and Josh Holloway. But that is so stupid, because then, like, he's dying or whatever. His artery's been nicked, and he's like, we already made out. I was like, that's so soapy. It's so silly.
Well,
like,
that's why I think
love triangle stuff. You know?
This episode is the one of the first ones. I mean, all of them sort of just twist the dial a little bit to change our perception. Like, I feel like our perception of Sawyer is more of a slow roll. And this, I don't know if I necessarily think that they mean to, like, make you like Sawyer by the end of this episode. You have more questions. Like, I walk away from this episode with more questions about, like, what really was in, you know, what's Sawyer's whole deal? How did he get away from the now very dangerous debt that he appears to have created by walking out on that deal? How does he end up on the plane? Stuff like that. Like, I think that this, episode doesn't make Sawyer, likable so much as it just makes him more interesting, which this character needed. Otherwise, he was just going to be the douchebag.
Yeah, the on-call antagonist.
Yes, right.
Whenever you needed something.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Can I talk about Sun for a second?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's.
Okay. Well, so a couple things quickly. Like, Shannon, this whole, like, this is the first I'm hearing of it with her asthma. I read on Lustpedia that apparently, like, this is supposed to be two other characters, like a man, an older man and his lovely wife who has asthma. And, like, they just transplanted that over to, Shannon and Boone and basically didn't change any dialogue pretty much except for, you know, explaining why we haven't seen Shannon use her inhaler before that.
I guess breathing's not breathing's cool.
Yeah, something like that. But I think as just as you said, like, Sawyer needed some deepening, some complications. Shannon needed this to, like, make her so much more vulnerable. Like, I've said throughout, I've really enjoyed this sort of, like, reassessment of Shannon through the lens of 2019. I like her so much better this time. I feel like we've already seen her vulnerabilities. I think Maggie Grace has done a good job with that. But to make her so vulnerable immediately makes her a much more dimensional character. And I think Maggie Grace does a good job with that whole part of it.
And yeah, one of the things we talk about with Shannon is that she's constantly being underestimated, and she has this in her mind that she constantly is saying stuff like, I'm worthless or I'm not useful. And she's got a real hang up about it. And this is sort of the next level of that. Like, it's bad enough for Shannon to worry that she's not useful on the island. It's a whole other level for her to be very self-conscious of being seen as, like, weak or in need of help or, you know, that's, I would imagine in Shannon's mind, even worse than just not being able to be helpful. Which is like, I need somebody to take care of me, which is a theme that I think we'll see again from Shannon.
Yeah. And then the Sun thing is, someone wrote into us being like, why do we think Sun has herbology skills? Is this something that a rich city girl, would have? Is this some sort of, like, slightly stereotypical, oh, she's Asian, so she must understand herbs, sort of thing. And I don't think the show ever gives us a satisfactory answer to that. So, so there's that.
So maybe.
it had never occurred to me, and I think it's right to kind of call it out. And then number two, I was reminded of Dave's, like, biggest annoyance in shows when I'm just like, Sun asks Michael to, like, get her eucalyptus. He goes to get her eucalyptus, and then he brings it back to her, and then Jin comes up, and he's, like, suspicious and weird. And, like, Sun can't turn around and be like, it's for the girl who's dying over there? Like, why doesn't she just say, I'm trying to prevent that girl from dying? Like,
yeah, also, why didn't she just send Jin out for the flowers?
Yeah, well, apparently there's a cutscene where Sun talks about helping her, and Jin's like, let's not mix in. Let's not get involved.
Okay.
So, like, that kind of makes sense. But at the same time, like, if you get quote unquote caught, you know, and like, you know, she just sort of, like, walks away, which is somewhat defiant.
Yeah, which leaves it up to Michael. And thank God he has, like, the wherewithal to be like, just don't, man.
I know, but it's so silly because she just be like, hi, that girl over there is dying. So I've decided to do something to help her not die. The end. Like, it's very silly. Anyway, I'm glad that Sun knows the recipe for Vicks Vapor Rub. I would not have that wherewithal. And I liked how stupid Jack felt when she came up with that elegant solution.
Mm.
Call a point. question for both of you, is asthma psychosomatic? because you just need to calm down and breathe some menthol in order to cure asthma.
I mean, I don't think asthma is psychosomatic.
No, it's not.
But panic attacks, if having asthma is giving her a panic attack, what Jack does, I imagine would be helpful. I don't think it's going to cure it, though.
I imagine we could add this to, like, this episode has a couple medical improbabilities. One would be, you know, asthma plus psychosomatic asthma. And the other one has to be that Charlie's very charming for still detoxing, don't you think?
Well, Charlie's sort of done detoxing.
Do you think part of Charlie's detoxing method is to like extreme mime work? Because his mime work is just like on point. Mm-hmm. Like, much love.
Charlie's secret is he does see the peanut butter.
Like
he's been bulking up again after losing all that heroin weight by eating food that's not real.
Emily DeRaven, like, much love to her, but her mime skills leave much to be desired. I felt the weight of that peanut butter on Dominic Monaghan's hand. Like, he did his work. He has a future in miming. No one cares.
Everyone's still showing up on Lost, which is good, because I don't think that's always the case on this show, but definitely first season. You want him to mine some peanut butter, he's gonna, like, get in there and do it. Everyone's, like, trudging through the jungle and with cameras and like the rain. Everybody's bringing it still. Well, I'm glad that Claire's, I wanted to talk that because Claire's back. We've been missing Claire for a few episodes, but now, you know, she's back and she gets to talk again, which is nice because now we get to have the connection between her and Charlie, which means I don't have to bleep that out when every time we talk about those two characters knowing about each other. Flirting.
Charlie. I love the Charlie. Peanut butter scene. The peanut butter scene is one of my all-time favorite scenes. It's like one I remember very well from the show.
It's one that sticks around better through age than
would you say that
torturing.
It sticks to the roof of your mouth?
Ooh.
That scene?
Yes, good.
Good.
In a good way. Yeah, and like the golden Labrador way where I'm just having a great time licking it off the top of my mouth all day.
Quick question. For both of you, that I don't know the answer to, genuinely. Crunchy or smooth? Neil.
Crunchy.
Oh,
crunchy.
Dave. Whoa, okay.
We don't know how to do this in order, but we definitely agree that it's crunchy.
It's smooth, but that's okay. Like, thanks for playing, but the answer is smooth.
I wonder if there's like a thing about it where it's like certain types of people, you know, like, if, you know, if, like you're a smooth
like
person.
You're
so.
Do Gemini's
Java classic makes her
Gemini
own smooth peanut butter, and I go out of my way to then buy chunky peanut butter, and it really, I think it annoys her.
Peanut butter is a very personal meal, it seems.
It is, and it divides entire countries and cultures, and then write us down into the podcast family.
I mean, there's a thing that, like, as a Northern California hippie, I'm a little bit of a Northern California hippie. I eat a lot of kale. That's all. But I really want to be into like super, super natural peanut butter. Like that's my inclination is to buy super, super natural peanut butter. But that shit is disgusting because it like separates into like an inch of oil on the top. And I know you're supposed to mix it in, but you don't want to like, you don't want to be part of that process.
Yeah. It's weird. And I don't like it.
Yeah. I hate it. I want like of all the things that I buy, the most processed probably is the Skippy smooth peanut butter, which is my favorite, has all kinds of chemicals, just keep it emulsified and I don't need to worry about it. That's my jam. But you know, Charlie prefers invisible peanut butter and that's more power to you, bud. Also, Dominic Monaghan's, aka Charlie's, fingers very dirty in that scene.
Everybody's fingers are
so
very dirty.
So
no one should be eating with those hands.
But here's another supply emergency on the island. Jack is running low on hydrogen peroxide, so
too many scrapes.
Watch out!
And too many fingers to soak because there's a torture scene in this episode, which I don't know, Jordan, if this is going to play into your most 2004 thing of the episode, but is a very 2004 thing of the episode. We're in like, what, season 3 or 4 of 24 at this point? Yeah. We are literally torturing people as a nation in a war. And so television's way of reacting to that is by bringing it into our fiction in ways that are supposed to make us super uncomfortable. But what I've learned in this rewatch is apparently they overshot because this seems super tame.
Oh, that's interesting. I today spent some time looking up interviews from Naveen Andrews, like to see if people were asking him about like stereotypes and blah, blah, blah. But it's exactly what Neil brought up the other day when he said that Dominic Monaghan was like clapping himself on the back for like the fact that they had two characters, speaking in Korean on the show. Like they were just taking victory lap after victory lap, for the fact that Saeed was like a sympathetic character. And no one was really sort of like, I think that character now seems slightly problematic, but then seemed very progressive. And we talked about this a little bit before already, and we will talk about it even more. Oh, joy of joys on next week's episode, Saeed episode. But yeah, I don't know. I am uncomfortable watching a brown man torture a white man on a show now. This is exactly the kind of content that we got a review asking us not to talk about, but that's how I feel. I can't help myself.
To talk about like what two white people, like in the equivalent, 24 will go on to have Jack Bauer ripping a hotel lamp out of the wall to use the wires on the nipples of the person who's like dating a woman he likes, but also might be involved in this conspiracy. He doesn't end up being involved in the conspiracy, but we learn that after he shocks him in the nipples with the electrical cord. So I just feel like in terms of what broadcast television was showing in terms of torture to get their point across, decided to just have it be a story point and not necessarily lean into the gratuity of it, which I agree with, or just didn't go far enough if we're really supposed to. The stabbing is the thing that crosses the line, and that happens as a result of like a tussling and some bad information.
Did you write tussle in your notes?
Did I write tussling? No, I did everything as versus this episode.
Wrestling.
Wrestling.
Definitely. There's some wrestling.
They wrestle. And then, oops, a knife in the bicep. The old knife in the bicep.
The old knife right through the bicep. But yeah, it makes sense what you're saying about at the time they were just happy to have like a positive character. So I imagine that's why we also get the self-exile of Saeed at the end of the episode, even though, as we'll talk a little bit in the storm, I'm not sure this is the place in the season one story it should have happened. But he gets to be okay in the sense that he is immediately so shocked at what he let himself do against his own previous wishes. Apparently, we'll find out next week that he has to go a-traveling on the mysterious jungle, in the mysterious jungle. Unless we have other things we need to address, I'm going to throw to Joanna for most 2004 thing in this episode.
Neil?
Oh, no, I feel like we've covered all the things I wanted to say. I'm anxiously awaiting the most 2004 thing in this episode.
Okay. First, I need to look up really quickly what year Love Actually came out. Oh, Love Actually came out in 2003. Love Actually is the film where I learned what a banoffee pie is. It gets a mention in this episode. That's not the most 2004 thing. I was just sort of trying to remember when I learned what a banoffee pie was. It was Love Actually and then repeated here. Okay. Our candidates for the most 2004 thing of the episode Confidence Man are number one, Kate's wide-legged khaki cargo bootcut pants. This isn't the first time we've seen them, but they're just... They're all the styles. I was
they're at the height of their power in this episode.
I was watching an episode of Lost the other night with someone who worked at Old Navy, when this show came out, and it's like all Old Navy stuff. And he's like, and we could, like, we would watch Lost and be like, oh, there's the cap sleeve Henley, like whatever. So anyway, Kate's like, little cap sleeve Henley with the cargo bootcut pants is very 2004 to me. Claire's necklace. carved into a Chinese character. Translated, the character means love. So Claire's white girl wearing a Chinese character necklace move. And then, the casting of Michael DeLuise. Michael DeLuise plays the husband of, or he's the Mark, right, in the con. And he's son of Dom DeLuise, if you didn't know. But also, this was like the height of his pop culture film, because he's a character actor. He's been in a bunch of stuff, but people know him best for his work on The Gilmore Girls. And this is the time when he was like at his height on The Gilmore Girls as TJ, Luke's brother-in-law on The Gilmore Girls. So the presence of Michael DeLuise.
And his haircut.
And his haircut, sure. And then the other is something that Neil already brought up, which is the Blind Boys of Alabama's I Shall Not Walk Alone, which is the 2002 track. And fun fact about that, it is the second time ever on the show, or the first of two times ever on the show, that they use non-diegetic music on the show. So you might have noticed some tunes earlier. Those came from Hurley's Discman, but we did not
see compact disc player,
not branded Discman, but we did not see him in this episode listening to the Blind Boys of Alabama I Shall Not Walk Alone. So is it Kate's khakis, Claire's necklace, Dom DeLuise's son Michael, or the Blind Boys of Alabama, I Shall Not Walk Alone? What's the most 2004 thing about this episode, Neil?
I'm going with the khakis.
Yeah, that's a good choice.
Those are great.
Dave.
Claire's necklace.
Claire.
It means love in Chinese. Anyway.
And that's the most Avril Lavigne
after
thing
the baby,
on this show.
She's planning on getting it as a tattoo.
Yep.
I think Claire and Charlie are meant to be because they're both necklace wearers. I think they're the two most necklace wearers on the show, by the way. So, you know. There is actually, it's spoilery, but if you're into it, there's a whole necklace entry page on Lostpedia, which is where I found out what Claire's necklace meant. So that is it for the calm, I believe. Should we go to our conversation with the great Kristen Russo?
Let's.
Please welcome to the podcast another co-host of the Buffering Podcast and the founder of My Kid is Gay. It is Kristen Russo. Hello, Kristen.
Oh my gosh. Hello, Joanna. I've been waiting for this moment all my life.
So true story is this. Kristen and I have discussed over the years, maybe even, our penchant for a certain kind of character. This first cropped up around the Buffy podcast with the character of Spike. Buffy fans might be familiar with Spike. We discussed it around Game of Thrones with Jaime Lannister. And here we are today to talk about James Foyer Sword. Something we joked about once is that we wanted to have like a problematic fave podcast.
I mean, there's a lot of material there.
Yeah, there's a lot of good-looking white boys to talk about. We're going to talk about good looks and how much that plays into things and all of our thoughts about this sort of phenomenon of the problematic fave and its rise and fall and in popular culture. But I wanted to start by asking you, Kristen, in a spoiler-free way, which I know you're familiar with because you guys don't spoil things on Buffy, but like, in a spoiler-free way, what would you say to our listeners who are still vehemently on the I hate Sawyer train? It's challenging. We're only a few episodes into season one, but I've had a lot of people go like, really? Him? So what are your spoiler-free thoughts, if you have any, on that question?
So, I mean, right. And I think I can do this spoiler-free because it kind of aligns with the way that I feel about most of my problematic faves, which is getting more and more complicated as I peel back the layers of this, like, psychology. But, you know, obviously characters grow and we, like, learn. I think there's a line in this episode where I think it's Kate who says to Sawyer, somebody says to him, I think it's Kate, that she knows that there's a human, a good human in there. And I feel like that's sort of the arc of things, that like, as you learn more about a person, you learn more about their root, you learn more, and then they grow and they change and they learn. And so like, maybe we'll see some of that. And maybe that is why we are so into Sawyer and all the other problematic faves, but I feel complicated about it. I felt very messed up watching this episode.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, like this speaks, I think, to a slight weakness in the first season of Lost. And we've discussed this before where, it almost swerves a little too hard in one direction to try to fool you into thinking you know who this character is. And then they're like, JK, he wrote the letter. You know what I mean? Like, so, and they do similar things with some other characters. I think we have things to learn about a few of the other island occupants, but I think that's been tough for first time watchers to be like, since the show is trying so hard to make you think Sawyer is one character, mm-hmm. for first time watchers, they're like, I don't see, because for example, Spike, who is the main antagonist, co-antagonist, season two of Buffy. Of three, I guess. They don't introduce him trying to be like, ooh, he's evil, but just kidding. He's nice. Like, that's a different kind of progression. You know what I mean? And similarly with Jamie Lannister on Game of Thrones. You know what I mean? Like, we meet him pushing a kid out of a window and then we do get to peel back some layers, but Lost is just trying a little harder to misdirect you. And that can be, I think it stops doing that eventually, but that can be a little frustrating at first.
Yeah, but then I was like looking too, because I didn't remember how long this season was. And it's like, this is episode 8, right? And there are a lot of episodes for the first season. So I don't remember, what happens in the journey, but we are still pretty early on. So the fact that it is, I mean, I do wish there was a little bit more dimensionality at the start. It would make me feel better about 2004 Kristen in general, but, it is, it's sort of like they're going heavy handed because probably they want us to really feel the punch of peeling back those layers.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And, all right. So without pushing this, it's okay. And it's okay if you watch the whole thing and you don't like Sawyer. There are plenty of people who don't like Jamie Lannister or stuff like that. But like something I do want to say that's funny about our weakness for this character, I think, is that we're both staunch feminists. I will gladly pick up the moniker of staunch feminist.
Same.
You are a gay woman. Who in theory should be immune to like the dimples and abs and frosted tips of like all these various like bad boys. And yet here we are. So like, is it just like one thought that I had, you talk about an arc. We want an arc for a character. You know what I mean? And so if you meet, I don't know, Jon Snow, and then he's just like Jon Snow trying for like,
right,
several seasons, and I don't see any movement there, I'm not as interested as I am in a Jamie Lannister trying and failing and trying and failing and stuff like that. That's
exactly,
there's like movement there that's interesting. But there's also this question of oh God, it's so like Tumblr teen, like redemptive love, right? Like, cause oftentimes these archetypes and other players that I would put, I tried to make a little rudimentary list of TV problematic faves. They're often called like the bad boys, but I think that's kind of silly.
I hope that Jordan Catalano is on that list because he was the first of the, like, I had Sawyer, Spike, Jamie, and Jordan Catalano was the next in line that I was like, oh, there's another one.
Yes. Jordan Catalano, absolutely. Jordan Catalano of My So-Called Life fame. And, if you enjoy Kristen and you enjoy My So-Called Life, watch this spot. I'm just going to say that. Pacey Witter from Dawson's Creek. I don't know if you're a Dawson's Creek fan. Pacey's like,
I don't remember. Yeah, I was a Dawson Creek watcher, but not like vehemently. So I don't have like a super into Pacey.
Yeah, he's not quite in the same category, but he's, he sleeps with his teacher in the first season.
Yeah, that's actually what I remember.
And then he becomes like a favorite. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. So it's like, it's slightly different. And then he's more of like a fuck up, like a problematic fuck up or something like that. Dylan McKay from 90210.
The classic.
Yeah, the classic.
The classic. God, that's probably my root, in all honesty.
Tim Riggins, Friday Night Lights.
Oh no, Joanna, it's true across all TV shows.
Yeah. Did you watch Veronica Mars?
I did not, but tell me who my favorite character will be.
Logan Eccles, Veronica Mars. hardcore. Something that we talked about on Storm, when we were Storm of Spoilers, I forget why we brought this up, but there's this, someone started this meme called like, it was the exact diametric opposite of Manic Pixie Dream Girl. And so it was like, Demon Dream Boy, Depressive Demon Dream Boy, right? And like two examples they had of this type was the Phantom of the Opera, which is like, great, and Kylo Ren from Star Wars. And I'm these are slightly different than these other problematic faves, I think. Like, it's not quite as like creepily in a dungeon or, you know, evil, with the exception maybe of Spike, but like, I don't know. I guess everyone likes a redemption arc. Okay, I've been talking too long. Tell me.
But I agree. I think like, so obviously you're bringing in two elements. There's the physical look of these characters, because really like almost every single character that you just listed of the ones that I know have a particular look. Pacey might be a little outside of that circle.
That's true.
But like all the rest of them are sort of like, flipping their hair out of their eyes. I guess Spike doesn't do that, but he could or would if he had longer hair. they're like hunks, if you will. But then they want to be better. And I think that like definitely both are elements, but there's something about the, you know, I'm damaged in some particular way because of some particular reason that you're going to learn somewhere along the lines, and you can fix me. Because there's always a fixer, right? Like, that's the thing.
Yeah. And it's usually, like, in this heteronormative world, it's usually the girlfriend, the object, the affection.
Totally.
And so this idea, this equally powerful idea of, like, yeah, redemptive love, of, like, he's awful, except to me. Except for me, or like my love can change him or whatever. And which is like every time I have to articulate anything about this phenomenon, I want to like throw myself out a window, which we've talked about. Like I have a lot of shame around my feelings about the problematic fave, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure I'm not going to speak for you, but I know that my feelings are not just like when I have feelings about problematic faves, the reason it brings so much up for me is because the things I feel about those people on television have also informed my romantic interests over time. And so it's not just this like removed thing where I'm like, oh, watching TV. It's like, oh, this is in my psyche. Like I have always liked someone who is like less available and somebody who like, you know, is different with me than they are with other people. Like it's in there. So it's, and it's like part of me, the more that I explore it is like, oh wow, was it always there? Or like, did media create this for me? Did media or like underpin it at the very least?
Yeah. It's interesting because there are like certain, levels of problematic faves where I can't follow like the women of fan fiction, to where they're going. And one example I always think of is like Edward Cullen from Twilight.
Oh, yeah.
That's a, you know, not to offend our like Twilight loving listeners or whatever, but that is a character that, I think does model bad boyfriend behavior, you know, bad partner behavior. Like this guy is watching you while you sleep and that's dreamy. And I'm like, is it, you know?
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Only Spike watched, or only Angel watched Buffy sleep.
Yeah, Spike didn't do that. Only Angel like creepily sketched her while she slept. So like, you know, or same thing with like, you know, Tim Riggins might be, you know, drinking a six pack a day, but he's not like following Lila Garrity into dark alleys as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
And I don't know. So there are, I definitely have lines. It's not like every sort of broody character works for me. And even like we were trying to source this sort of nightmare demon boy prototype, which is once again different from our like largely blonde problematic faves or whatever, but like, back to the origin might be something like a Hamlet or a Heathcliff, like something like that, or like something from Shelley or something like that.
Right.
But those are guys where I'm like, get it the fuck together. I don't know. I'm not here for you. So there's something about it's this willingness, this desire to be better.
Right.
Not really Heathcliff's thing. You know what I mean? And that's the question of Kylo Ren, like why a lot of people think about Rey and Kylo Ren in that way, whether or not that's something that you are into, like the idea is not, we love Kylo Ren for who he is. It's like the idea is we love the idea of Kylo Ren trying to be better if maybe that's a possibility for him.
Something are you like saying that, when I watch Star Wars that I'm going to also like Kylo Ren?
If you ever see Star Wars, I forgot that you don't know.
I revealed it here publicly. Yeah. I'm not watching it now because one day I'm going to do a podcast with you, Joanna, where I watch it for the first time. I'm like a, you can't find many of me, you know?
Yeah, you're a unicorn. You're a Star Wars unicorn. Yeah. Kristen and I don't know if this is interesting podcasting material, but Kristen and I played a little game a little while ago after some tequila where I tried to have her tell me everything she knew about Star Wars. It's the funniest thing that's ever happened. And we might try to replicate it someday on a podcast.
Yeah, yeah, if you're lucky.
But if you know someone else who's never seen Star Wars, please do fill them with tequila and then ask them what they know
about
Star Wars. Yeah. All right. So maybe that's as far as we can take this sort of problematic fave theme. But just to say that, like, Sawyer is definitely on that list. It's okay if you never like him. It's definitely, well, I guess I'll follow up with this question. We had one listener sort of sounding off in our Patreon Slack about how annoyed he was that characters like Sawyer, or probably Spike, or definitely Logan, or, you know, Tim Riggins, mm-hmm. whatever, get a pass on their behavior because they're so good looking. That, like, that's an inevitable component to this archetype. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a little bit because I recently got an email too in the buffering verse that was, you know, we have a longstanding, especially, Jenny has a longstanding running thing with hunks, right? She loves a hunk. Yeah, and I do too. I love a hunk. And we had an email come in that was sort of like, hey, you all talk about smashing the patriarchy all the time, but then also you say you love hunks. And like, isn't the hunk sort of like the archetype of the patriarchy? Like, isn't that just it? And it's like, yeah. And also, is that why I love them? I don't know, but it's sort of like, maybe I've said this before on some podcast somewhere, but there are certain things that I call like getting a manicure in my mind, where I'm like, I know that like if I was born in a world where these structures didn't exist, I would not get such satisfaction from getting my nails painted. But when I get my nails painted, I feel composed and together and centered. And like, I know that it comes from a structure that is like totally messed up in a lot of ways, but I still can't separate the feeling. That's a little bit of the way that I feel about the hunkishness of these characters, and that it affects me despite my awareness of the problem. Like, I can't pull that apart. I can't take the feeling out of my body. It's there.
It's so funny because like Jenny's fascination with hunks and your fascination with like problematic faves, which is slightly different than a hunk, like, you know, from once again, two gay women, is just like, that's to me the purest form of appreciation for these things. Cause it doesn't come necessarily, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, it doesn't come from the same place that it comes from, like, for some of us, you know, it comes from a different place of just sort of like this character type or this, like, you know, the hunk, the idea of a hunk is more kind of like dopey to me, like Boone. You know, on Lost is a classic hunk, I would say. And that's not my, you and I are not interested in that. That's Jenny's territory. But like, but you know, and then like you add Brood to that and you get, you know, the problematic fave, I suppose. Well, but yeah, I mean, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, what's fun too is that like, I think you and I are both pretty staunch feminists and speak as such out there in the world. And like, I'm constantly, and I think you as well, we're both after like figuring out more, learning more about structures. And like, what's cool is that, yeah, we have these things we can't separate from our lived experience, but we also get to use them to do things like this. It's like, we're not just out there sort of like googly-eyed at the problematic fave. We're like googly-eyed because we can't help it. And then we're saying like, what's happening here? And like, how can we unpack it? Which is powerful.
Yeah. And what is the power of this archetype over, I don't know, women or people, you know, because like a lot of men are into these characters as well. It's a compelling story that goes beyond the glistening abs and the dimples, I swear.
We want to believe that people are good. Like, it's like, that's at least, I think that's mostly human nature, is like wanting to believe that humans are good because you're a human. So you want to just believe that like there's goodness and there's the ability for redemption in everyone. Is that true? Probably not.
but we can always hope.
But we hope.
So yeah, and I mean, like, there are some people who also, like, villains are often the most interesting characters, not even like because we want them on a redemptive path, just because villainy is like, villainy is movement, villainy has a purpose, you know what I mean? And so that's just I don't know, it's something interesting to watch. So yeah, so is there anything else like Sawyer specific we want to say? Oh, I will say one other thing in our, you know, donning our social justice warrior capes or whatever. This seems to be, you know, the list that I came up with were all, white guys.
Yeah.
I had trouble trying to think of non-white problematic faves.
Well, and I think that's real, right? Like, yeah. I think that
it's it's an arc that is afforded to white characters that characters of color don't often get.
100%. And like historically reflects especially the like era of television that we're looking at.
Right.
When the problematic fave, I think, was even more. I mean, I don't know. I feel like it was even more prevalent in the like 90s and early 2000s than it is now.
Late 90s, early aughts was like the heyday of the problematic fave. Everyone just trying to be Dylan McKay, basically.
Dylan McKay route really is getting me. I'm like, holy shit.
One thing, we should say that's Luke Perry's character in 90210 for our younger listeners.
Yes,
The last thing I'll say that I think is kind of funny is Ian Somerhalder, who plays Boone, went on to play another like favorite TV problematic fave over on The Vampire Diaries, Damon Salvatore. And he's tremendously good at it. And he said in an interview that he basically stole Josh Holloway's tricks and transplanted them over to this vampire character he played on The Vampire Diaries. So
wow, yeah. That's incredible.
And yeah, like, these characters often steal a show. Like Pacey stole Dawson's Creek from Dawson, and like Sawyer, I think, steals Lost from, not entirely from Jack, but like in a way, you know. And like Dylan steals 90210 from Brandon, you know what I mean? Like, because these are the characters we want to watch. I can't remember the name of the poor quarterback in it's not Jason Street, it's Tim Riggins. You want to watch Tim Riggins. So that's just where we are.
Right. And then that's because of the arc that you're talking about, right? That there's more journey there. And so we always want to like watch that more than anything else, or at least I do. I don't have anything like, I mean, you know, obviously I watched this episode and I'm like, I'm kind of curious to watch more of Lost now because I don't remember the whole arc. Obviously I remember the massive pieces, but I was like, really, Kristen? Like this was just such an extreme portrait of like, sexism and racism, and like there was just a fucking lot in here with Sawyer that I am curious to watch some more to see where it goes.
Let's talk about it. I mean, like, what, you know, it's funny because with distance we're like, remember all of Sawyer's nicknames? They're so funny and cute. And for like the first like at least third, if not more, of season one, it's like a lot of racial shit and you're like, no, awful. Right.
Like,
so,
literally, I was like, oh, this is a thing. Like, it's really something. I'm about to finish the last episode of my L Word rewatch right now, which is the same year, 2004, was both shows. And so I'm really rooting in like what was happening in 2004 for Kristen that like, I was completely unaware of so much. And I do wonder how my interactions with these characters would have changed if I had some of the awareness that I have now, about everything. Like racism obviously is a massive thing that I have like grown to more thoroughly understand in the last, you know, 15 years, but also just sexism in general. Like I wasn't even aware of the nuanced pieces of that, even as a woman walking in the world that as I am today. So. Yeah, I mean,
watching Sawyer walk out of the ocean with nothing on and just sort of like waggling his penis at Kate. I'm just like,
right?
No,
like it was, yeah. And like, I'm sorry, but like, I didn't even remember till I rewatched this episode that there's a whole arc, the whole point, the whole thing he wants the whole time is for her to kiss him.
Yeah,
and then she likes it. That like,
wow. I know.
Just wow.
I know. She loves it. And what's worse is that I watching it also loved it. I was like, that is a fucking hot kiss.
I mean, right. And it is a good kiss. I mean,
oh,
like,
if we just take, good, yeah.
Yeah, we're taking the context out. That is one of the better kisses I've ever seen on television. But it's like so fucked up on so many levels and like is not dealt with. Most of it is not dealt with at all, which is wow.
Yeah. No, exactly. And like the fact that it's swerving, it's pushing too hard. Mm-hmm. Because like there's this conversation with Kate at the end where she's like, I was trying to figure out why you did all this and why you did that. And it's because you want to be hated and you want to be like punched up because you hate yourself and you want to die and like all this sort of stuff. And like while that all may be true, it's just like, would he really let Shannon gasp for air?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like fucking with people, I don't mind if Sawyer like fucks with people. When like Shannon can't breathe, and yes. like if he were just like, no, really, I don't. I mean, he does say I don't have them, but like mm-hmm. if he was really like, I don't know, really, I don't have them in a believable way, mm-hmm. then maybe they could start looking for other alternatives. The sun's already all over it.
Sun's
like,
on
don't
it.
Worry, yeah. I've heard of eucalyptus. And Jack's like, but I was gonna punch the answer out of it.
Oh God, this is yeah. the real joy for me because I have not seen an episode of Lost since it went off of the air. So I was like, oh my God, remember all these guys?
Yeah.
Oh, but yeah, and I think it's all like to tie a bow around our problematic faves. Like I think that the look, there's like a moment in the Kate and Sawyer scene at the end of this episode where Kate is looking at Sawyer and she's like full of like pity and desire all at the same time. Ugh. And I'm like, well, isn't that just it? Right? Like, it's just like, that's if you want to know what Kristen looks like when she's looking at problematic faves, that's it. That's the look where I'm like, oh no, I can help you. I can help you. Kiss me.
Yeah. It's just, that sound you just made. That's me. Like, if I get like swept up. Like sometimes I was just watching, I will just say this to our, like our holdouts who are still angry about Sawyer or whatever. A, I hear you and understand you. B, my roommate Diana, our podcast producer who, is watching Lost for the first time, hates Sawyer until we actually just watched the season one finale and she's like, okay.
Right.
So we got her, but it took a whole season.
Oh, welcome,
so
Diana.
Hopefully it won't take a whole season. I know that this episode actually got a lot of our listeners. But I don't know if it'll take longer for some, and if some, it will never happen. But Diana was just like, all right. And then I was just like watching and sort of like clutching my hands in like prayer formation going like, look at his face. Cause he was just like so wounded. And I was like, oh God, Joanna.
Oh God.
Get it together. Yeah. Ugh.
We're hopeless. At least we know we're hopeless.
Pretty bad. All right. Well, I'm going to do this backwards, but can I ask you really quickly, what is your Lost origin story? Like, how did you first start watching?
Oh, yeah. So I actually have, I think, a pretty interesting Lost origin story, that actually involves Jenny, and my friend Ingrid. So, I lived with my friend Ingrid in whatever the year was that season 5 of Lost was airing. And, she was a massive fan. She had watched all the seasons. And so in my house, she would host Lost parties, which was actually one of the like first ways that I had like met Jenny a couple of times, but that was like really how I got to know Jenny and like several other people who lived in Brooklyn at the time, most of them musicians. They would all come over. And so I would join the party, but it was season 5 and I had seen nothing before season 5. So they would stand up on the, you know, from the couch and scream at the TV. And I was like, what is happening right now? So I went back and at the same time as I was watching season 5, I watched season 1. So you can imagine that fuckery. So I watched season 1 and season 5 like in parallel. And then I continued after season 5 ended. I watched seasons 2, 3, 4 and then 5 again to catch up with 6. And then that's when I started watching in real time and with knowledge.
Yeah. All right.
But it was, well, yeah,
that
it was,
is that's a real hop through time. you're in action with Lost. And then like, how do you think, I mean, like, I know that you were one of the people who were kind of excited to hear that we were coming back and doing like a Lost rewatch. So how does it stay with you these many years later? Like, how do you think about Lost now? How do you think about its impact on the culture?
I mean, I think a couple of things. Like, obviously, my whole life is kind of steeped in nostalgia at this point. So I've just, like, really found it so fun and also powerful to go back in, you know, a decade to two decades prior and think about these characters and arcs and all of that. So from a general standpoint, I'm excited as somebody who loved Lost. And as somebody who also loved Lost, I'm excited because for me, and I think for a lot of people, what this show will do, you know, for your new watchers, you don't know yet. You don't know yet. But it does a lot. And for me, it was the first time that I had ever really entered into a world like the world that Lost created. So I'm excited to revisit that with you all. Because now I've done that multiple times, but when Lost had happened, it was my first time through anything like that.
Yeah, I think that was true of a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It just came at, like, because it was a mystery box show and because, like, online fan culture was growing sort of simultaneously, it just was a perfect storm, if you will, of elements, that gave this experience. And it's an addictive experience because you're just sort of like, everyone's talking about something and everyone's excited about something. And you're all like excited about something that, this is something actually that Paul Fairfield, who's a sound designer on Game of Thrones, told me, when everyone was getting actually like kind of angry about the final season of Game of Thrones. She's like, isn't it kind of good that we all have like, and by we all, she means you all because she worked on the show and she's not angry about it, but she's like, that people have something to focus on that isn't like the misery of the world. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, it's a low stakes thing to get wound up about. And that's totally. That experience of fandom. I mean, sure, fandom traces back to like Beatlemania and beyond and stuff like that, but that kind of like shared watching, shared social platform, chat rooms, all that sort of stuff, mm-hmm. kind of fandom, that kind of community built around this thing, this story, is somewhat a function, a newish function of the late 90s, early aughts. And so that's, you know, an interesting time to think about.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
What we both said. Okay. Well, we're gonna dip into the storm, our spoiler section, really quickly to ask you just a few more questions about Lost in a spoilery way. So thank you for all of your time in the calm. Remind people where they can find you on the internet.
Yes, you can find me so most of my social handles are all my first and middle name, which is Kristin Noeline. I'll spell it for you. It's KristinNoeline. It's not Kristin Online, as many people think my name is. So you can use that, and you can check my website out. It's the same spelling, just KristinNoeline.com, and learn about Buffering and To Ellen Back, which is the L Word podcast. And also I do a lot of work with the LGBTQ community. So you can find all those things in all those places. Also, if you're in the New York City area, I'm throwing the 7th annual All Ages Pride Party at Housing Works Bookstore on Saturday. It's super, super fun. It's music and snacks and spoken word and a lot of pride. So come out to that if you can in New York City.
Now's the time of the show that you get to listen to a SpongeBob SquarePants Trap remix, and we thank our small council members. If you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers and join at the topmost level, we thank you on this segment of the show. We are in a new cycle, which means we are out of the Game of Thrones small council members and full on to these people who are just around for Lost. I would like to say thank you very much to Sarah Stone, Alexandria Neville, Matthew Wilson, Tim McGregor, Sarah Cooper, Megan Green, Jeff Libby, Amy Harper, Brian, no last name provided, Alex Marcus, Kat, no last name, EHR, the letters, and they're all capitalized, so I'm assuming it's an acronym and not ER, Day 11 Podcast, Matthew Munden, Mark Rodriguez, Jessica Trowbridge, Jay Fornes, Patrick Grattan, Riley Pratt, and Sarah Wolf.
And I've got a list that is of both folks who have joined us since Lost, and we're back around to the top of the list, I'm told. Anyway, I would like to thank Aaron Michael Augustini, Francis Adrian, Kevin Gonzalez, Jay Maggio, Eric Procyse, Arthur Winnie, Alicia Dennis, or Denis, Scott Rumsey, Richard Hoska, Tracy, Luke Sweet, Contrera. Oh, that's a very alluring one. Sheila Curran? Curran? Okay. Nate? Just Nate. Anthony Goel, Ralph Helm, Kelsey McKinnell, Chelsea Patchell, Adrian Martinez, and Samuel Fry.
And I want to thank Christopher McTair, Tarun Sully, Sam, Liz Zelikson, Kendall Abernathy, Thomas Hankins, Tony Rollins, Anna Jackson, Will Nazer, Taylor Hughes, T. Legieu, Alyssa Love, Savio Nguyen, Georgia O'Brien, Timothy Clayton, Eleanor Corkish, Alejandro Villarreal, Rachel Aluli, Cassidy, and Ross Stewart. Thank you guys so very much.
And we're back for the storm section. You know that means spoilers because you know this podcast. Usually I throw over to Joanna to kick us off, but I want to track something that's been I've been waiting this whole podcast to say, which is Locke did it all by lying.
I was also going to start with a Locke check in with you because this is the most, I think this is the most lyingest we see Locke. Because here's the deal, and I want your opinion on this, obviously, but like we talked about this last week in the storm that like, since Locke is the one who knocks Saeed out, and then Saeed comes to Locke's like, what's your alibi? And he's like, I was skinning a boar, but have you thought about Sawyer? And here's a fucking knife. Go fuck him up. Bye. Like, and also anyone who has watched a TV show knows how to set a slow, like, delay fuse.
That one's the most ridiculous one. But then he says, a cigarette. And I was like, oh, I know what you're talking about, but I never would have thought that. And I watch a lot of TV.
Fuck. Apparently in the original script, he said, anyone who served in the military knows how to do a slow delay fuse. And I guess they cut that because Sawyer was in the military. I don't know why, but, that was a stupid line.
That would have made a little bit more sense.
I feel like,
It's because he's talking to a person who was in the military. Why you would write that line in the first place. But like,
I guess, but if he's trying to throw
I shouldn't have to tell you that the smoker would know how to.
Oh, fair.
You know.
Oh, fair. Okay. That being said, our debate about Locke being a villain or not going forward, or an antagonist or not, I feel like at least in the future when Locke does his various things, the worst of which is probably like plunging a knife in Naomi, I think, later in the series, maybe. He doesn't really lie about it. He's just sort of like, or maybe it was like luring Sawyer to a boat to kill his dad for him or something like that. I don't know. Locke does a lot of shit, but like he doesn't usually like really lie about it in such a blatant way. He's usually like just doesn't answer questions. And then
he keeps it very obtuse.
Yeah.
You can see where they kind of try it, where he, instead of telling Saeed that it was probably Sawyer, he sort of gives Saeed this spiel about you know, who's profiting off the fact that we're staying on this island? Like, who's doing well since we got here?
Right.
You know, sort of trying to lead him. But it's such a weirdly obvious ploy. It's like, all right, John. We get it.
I feel like later when they're writing Locke, he would have said something like, no, why would I ever want to do something like that? You know what I mean?
Right. Like, just ask an open-ended question.
Just ask a question and then just smile weirdly and keep whittling his stick or something. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. All that's the same.
I mean, and he is sort of like projecting out some of the things that are true about him, where he is a person that wants to stay on the island and does things to try and stay on the island. He's just directing it at Sawyer, I guess, just to cause chaos.
It's consistently Locke on these like little weird side quests with people, trying to manipulate them. And it has been consistently now for enough episodes that I feel very confident striding further into season one that my weird ass proclamation in the storm of the pilot episode is gonna, I'm gonna hold to this. Villain, straight up villain. Antagonist or foil might have been softer words for different episodes, but in this one, he definitely causes Sawyer to get stabbed in the arm. That has to be something he's expecting to happen.
And he just, why did he give him a knife? It was, so much. Anyway, if we're like, if say I had a chart with like a sliding thing and like on any given week, I'm like villain or not villain, I'll slide it over to villain this week for you, Dave.
Yeah.
You get a told ya this week. I mean, it's not going to stay there, but you know, you can have it.
One week at a time. the other thing is that I think that given what we know about Saeed eventually being kidnapped by Russo and learning some more mysteries of the island, it feels weird to have the whole Locke hits him over the head plot in there at all. Maybe, I mean, you guys have rewatched season one more recently than I have, so maybe that, you know, falls into some huge reveal later on. But if the point was to get Sawyer or to get Saeed away from the others, I feel like just have him not come back to camp when he gets knocked out, and it kind of gets you where you need to be a week.
I mean, we can talk about it next week, but I think we can look at like him trying to, you know, like the torturer becomes the tortured or whatever in next week's episode. So it's sort of like he feels like he needs to have some kind of penance for what he does for Sawyer and is being like chained up and tortured by Russo. That penance, like perhaps so.
Well, and there's a thematic parallel because there's a lot of this episode where Sawyer spends his time wanting to be hated or sort of egging on the torture, because as we're learning about him, he's sort of beaten up. He's spent a lot of his life beating up on himself.
Yeah, I guess I'm fan fixing things in my head, but it also just like makes it more complex if, like, you know, Jack just keeps trying to be mean and has to like deal with it.
They also seem really interested in this moment in starting to really push into the love triangle stuff. Like, there's, you know, other than he's just sort of shitty sometimes or all the time, there's no other reason for Sawyer to be like taunting Jack about making out with Kate, because like Jack and Kate aren't really a thing except in Sawyer's mind at this point, yeah. I guess.
But then like Jack, like a little baby, like still gives him a looks over at Kate. It like works. It works every time on Jack. It's so on the rewatch. It's so aggravating. It's like the only, like, I think Josh Holloway and Evangeline Lilly have great chemistry. I think she has great chemistry with Matthew Fox. I think she has great chemistry with a fucking like rock. Like, if it's Evangeline Lilly, she's adorable and hot. She's got it all, but like, but the way in which it's like in theory, I like this love triangle because in theory, it's like is Kate going to be with the guy that, you know, fits with her old self? Or is she going to be with the guy who fits with the person that she wants to like fresh start be?
Mm-hmm. And like the guy who literally told her in the pilot, we're all dead. We get to start over on this island.
Yeah, and it would just help if Jack weren't like so sporadically judgmental of everyone, including Kate. You know what I mean? Like that's not a great part of it. And then it all gets sort of stymied by the fact that like Sawyer himself has his own like much better character growth by the end of it. Like, I don't see a lot of Kate character growth from here to the end, but you see a lot of character growth for Sawyer. So then the love triangle, we'll get to it, but the whole like quadrangle Juliet stuff, it's like it's both great and not. We'll get to all of that eventually. But all right. So other storm.
Is that the first time we've mentioned Juliet on this podcast at all?
Jenny.
Doo-doo.
Jenny last week during the interview part said she loves an upcoming character with the initial J in her name. And then because she was trying to keep it calm. And then in the storm part of our chat, she talked about how much she loved Juliet because she looks like a sexy velociraptor. And
sexy velociraptor.
So yeah, love Juliet, sexy velociraptor. Doctor, sexy velociraptor. anyway, yeah, there's not a ton of storm stuff to talk about because there's no real like island lore.
This is all about the politics versus the magic. This is like the parallel discussion that we had with Game of Thrones, which is like, is the show more interested in the politics of the survivor stuff, or is it more interested in the lore, the magic, the weird shit that's happening on the island? This episode leans way in one direction.
Yeah. Well, we're only into, like, we're on 8, and
it still is only
Hatch comes in at the end of 11. So we're getting
to the Hatch, and then it's only day 9 on the island.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this really is like, this also sort of reminds me of 24 a little bit, where it's like the physical pace or the in-world pace is very slow. Like, we're seeing almost every day with these characters so far.
Well, I did want to give a Storm answer to Dave's Hurley question, which is like, Hurley does wind up hoarding food, but it's like the Dharma food that he hoards.
Right.
And it's sort of like so as far as we know, he's not hoarding food at this point. And like, it does become like somewhat of a Walt problem, right? Like Walt, the child actor, keeps growing. Like, you know, this actor who plays Hurley does not get any much slimmer, maybe somewhat slimmer, like on his time. Is that realistic?
He gets better wardrobe in his Dharma seasons.
He does. Yeah. And his hair grows out. It's the hair that's really like not working for him right now, honestly, in season one. But like, the idea of like feeling the need to explain why Hurley looks the way he does X many months or whatever into their stay on the island. And then like, do I feel like that's always successful? No. Do I still maintain that like he's a character who has a lot of dignity on the show? Yes, especially given how the show ends. So, all of that. And then I had some emails to read, unless there's anything else we want to talk about. Stormwind.
Emails.
All right. So this first one comes from Ariel Rodriguez, and it's, I don't know really why I put it in the Storm, but I did, just because like maybe some music cues are spoilery. But Ariel writes in, and he writes, I'm beyond ecstatic that you're doing this. I'm an episode or two behind the cast. The podcast may request something in the discussion of White Rabbit. I was surprised when no time was spent on the score. This is the first time, to my knowledge, that the theme life and death is heard. It's weird, distorted. Notice how it plays out almost atmospherically with some very dissonant notes being played at the same time. It's beautiful. It's disturbing. It's life and death. If there can be some time dedicated to the music, I would love it. Lost made me fall in love with the TV show, and the score has so much to do with it. Remember when Locke pounds on the hatch screaming to the heavens? Oh, that's why it's in the Storm. How the music swells and we just get how he feels. I think since these songs have just as much power, just as much importance to the story as the characters, small Easter eggs, I think whenever an important song comes up or a theme is introduced, one should bring it up, please, he says. All right. This is just something that I would like send a call out to our listeners to try to flag this stuff for us. It's something I am and have always been notoriously bad at, which is identifying themes on TV shows. I'm really bad at it with Game of Thrones. I can do like 5, and there's like millions of them. That being said, there's one theme that I love the most, which is like the adventuring traveling theme. And that's why I put it in my fireside.
Oh, the one that almost sounds like, there was a Star Wars Force Awakens track. I think it's called The Jedi Steps. And the Lost, like, going on a mission theme sounds very similar.
Oh, nice. I'll have to listen to those together. But it's a very jaunty one. And I can recognize Life and Death as well. That's another one I know. But, like, I was recently digging through the tracks. Michael Giacchino, by the way, who composed the music on Lost, names his tracks very stupid pun things. Like, did you guys know this about him?
No.
All right, let me look up. Well,
I mean, maybe, but also I didn't know this specifically about him.
Do you guys have any soundtrack thoughts while I look up some of these classic Giacchino things?
I think they, in the Lostopedia, they do reference the first time themes are played. So I could try to do a better job of bringing those things in, but I'm also not great unless it's tied to like a huge moment. Because yeah, I did start just learning them as like the running through the jungle track, the something's chasing you track. I have no idea what the names are for like calling them out.
So for example, the traveling one, which is my favorite one, is called Hollywood and Vines. Cause it first comes up when they're climbing the vines, like with Shannon and stuff like that in the valley. Charlie Hangs Around is the name of the track when they like find Charlie hanging from vines. yeah. Crocodile Lock is a nice topical Rocket Man, one. Locked Out Again, Thinking Clearly. Shenanigans is like maybe the
shenanigans
worst. Shenanigans, there it goes. Booneral for Boone's Funeral. Kate's Motel instead of Bates Motel. Anyway, so basically like there a lot of the names are spoilers and they're terrible puns. So, you know, that's the thing.
I will say this. He does a really great job of like shaping the soundtrack in a way with like unique instruments. There's like a lot of like wind chimey stuff in the Lost score. That's great. It kind of reminds me of like what Bear McCreary does with BSG, Battlestar Galactica with the drums, where like it sets this like foundation for all of the score. And it's pretty great. I mean, it's funny because when you listen to it on its own, it doesn't have as many of those, at least in my mind, it doesn't have as many of those tracks where it's like, oh, now I remember this scene. The scene comes back to life. For me, it's more like season to season for Giacchino. Like every season sort of has its own sonic template for him.
Oh, I like that.
And so that'll be an interesting thing to explore as we go forward. Like that was always kind of the thing. Like the Game of Thrones ones, it's like each character has their own thing and they each like house has its own thing. Ramin Djawadi sort of weaved them together as the seasons went on. But I really do remember Giacchino having like very sort of distinct scores for each, you know, and there's just little tie-ins here and there. But, so yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah. I think the season 4 finale, There's No Place Like Home, Part 1 and 2, has my favorite, if I recall correctly, that's when they're looking for the Orchid Station, right? I think. Yeah. That has my favorite musical moment. I remembered it, like, because someone was asking me about the music recently, and before my rewatch, I remembered the visual of it, which was, it's actually Ben moving slowly through the orchid, like, the top level of the orchid station, so like the orchid vines and stuff like that. I remembered that being the moment, but I couldn't remember when it was. And then I was like, during my rewatch, it's in the season 4 two-parter finale. And there's just this like, I think it's the cliffhanger between part 1 and part 2. And so everyone is just moving into position and there's music playing and it's my favorite. So, but yeah, we can be better. Apparently, I noticed that too, Dave, and I think according to the Lostopedia, this is the introduction of Sawyer's dark theme is in this episode.
Ooh. So,
there you go. Dark Sawyer. Is there anything else music wise we want to talk about other than, do we want to listen together to the track Booneral? No, we're good.
Okay. We'll get to the Booneral. Which now I can't call anything else.
That whole episode is now a different name in my mind.
Yeah, the Booneral episode.
Get me to the Booneral. All right. So, and then this last email comes from Randy, and this is like a classic. Joanna loves these emails, which is Randy wants to talk about the similarities between Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut and Lost. He mentions that Vonnegut, gets mentioned a couple times. They talk about being unstuck in time, which is a Slaughterhouse-Five sort of reference.
Yeah.
But the Vonnegut novel, he says that what the most teaches about Lost is actually Cat's Cradle, which is one that none of your hosts here have read. Not only does the main action take place on an island, but the politics of the island are balanced between a perceived dark force in the form of a dictator and a perceived light force in the form of Bakonin, the local mystic and founder of Bakoninism. Furthermore, the island turns out to be the epicenter for the destruction of mankind from exposure to Ice Nine. Unlike Lost, the island in Cat's Cradle is described as worthless, and the light and dark forces are working together to dupe the masses. But aren't Jacob and the Man in Black just playing games for a while as well? Nevertheless, the novel shares the humanist mission behind every Vonnegut novel, to beg us to be better to one another. What is Lost if not a humanist love letter that begs us to seek solace in one another? I mean, come on, it ends in a non-denominational church. Part of my personal investment in this rewatch is to continue to tie Lost to the themes of Cat's Cradle, but for now I just want you to consider how perfectly the language of Bakonanism seems to define the ideas of the center of Lost. And then here Randy listed a few terms, but I'm just going to hit you with one, which is Karass, K-A-R-A-S-S. And if you've never read a Vonnegut novel, like, you might be like, what? Yeah, Vonnegut, like, invents ideas and themes and stuff like that. It's a whole thing. But Karass, K-A-R-A-S-S, a group of people linked in a cosmically significant manner, even when superficial links are not evident. So that seems to be our survivors. So yeah, so, you know, Cat's Cradle, on a growing list of books, we started with Watership Down. Cat's Cradle is now another we will.
Yeah, and like, how can I live in a world where I've seen True Detective season 2, but I haven't read Cat's Cradle?
Yeah, how can you live in that world?
It just seems very unjust.
Cat's Cradle, which you just said, is now my favorite of your slips in this episode. But before that, it was ABC, which happened at the beginning of the episode. So.
I don't even remember saying that, but that's fantastic. Did I lock and lost anything throughout that? Oh, fun.
One that I really enjoy. Dave, you're the best. Thank you.
Nice. Well, sorry, but no, I'm not sorry for ABC. They don't care about me, and I don't care about them. Guys, until next week, we will be alone with Saeed. Or no, the episode's just called Solitary. We'll be checking with everybody. Let's figure out where you can find more of us on the internet. Let's start with Neil Miller.
Well, you can get me over at filmschoolrejects.com, where we just published a list of the 50 best comedies ever. It's a very good list. I had input. You can also get me on Twitter at rejects. And don't forget to visit our new website, stormpodcast.com, and follow us at stormpodcast.
Ooh, and Joanna Robinson.
You can find me on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can hear me covering the TV show Big Little Lies on the Still Watching podcast. We're talking about award season. In fact, this week we talked about everything from Chernobyl to Toy Story to Midsommar on the podcast Little Gold Men.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E and also on the Fighting in the War Room podcast. And here, telling you that even while we're on the island, to not fall down.